mute themselves as they see fit through the Serenity Prayer. Good evening, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, David.
We will be recording and publishing only the audio portion of this meeting on our website later. You will be able to send chat messages to the meeting hosts only. Ask It Basket questions should go to the user questions, which is actually Larry. I'm also going to post in the chat window Tidewater link to the TidewaterInnerGroup.org, AA.org, and AAVirginia.org when the time comes for the seventh tradition. We're not taking contributions directly at Simple Actions. We're just asking that people consider donating to those service entities. So for those who'd care to join us, let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Okay, the Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? If you could just raise your virtual hand. And while you're doing that, I will read the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So I see no virtual hands or otherwise, but if you are looking to connect, if you're new or if you're returning, if you came in alone, you do not have to leave that way. So please feel free to send a text or send a chat to one of the hosts, and we'll be happy to get in touch with you. We'll also leave some space after the meeting for anybody who wants to connect with other alcoholics, gather phone numbers, etc. So the format of this meeting is an open speaker Ask It Basket. Tonight, we are very excited to welcome Don Major from Louisville, Kentucky. After he shares his experience, strength, and hope with us, we'll take a break and we'll call for announcements. We'll do the seventh tradition, et cetera. And then we'll give everyone the opportunity to pose questions, and Don is going to stick around and answer them. We hope. So please feel free to send a question through the chat to the user questions when that time comes. So I'm just so excited to introduce Don to everybody. He's just one of the people I've listened to his tapes throughout the years. And I go up every year to Richmond where Al J puts on a thing up there the second weekend in January. And Don and Bob are always part of that. And I look forward to it every year going to start my year. And Don has also been very kind to our group and come into town and shared with us. And I've had the pleasure of getting to spend a little bit of time with him and get to know him a little bit. Just love you dearly, Don. And I thank you so much for coming to share with us tonight. And I am going to unmute you now. Thank you, Don. I love you, brother.
Love you, David, and thank you so much, and thank everybody for having me here. It's quite an honor to be at the inaugural meeting of the Simple Action Group, and my experience in Norfolk with the AA Fellowship there has just been wonderful, and I'm just so grateful to be with you folks. And over the next roughly hour, I'm going to try to follow directions, which is always a challenge for me. And I'm going to have to let God get me out of the way because that's too big a job for me. By the grace of God, my sobriety date's April the 9th of 1981. And I'm not a bit more capable of getting me out of the way tonight than I was in April of 1981. I've got to have divine intervention. And by the way, I probably will refer to divine intervention a number of times. And if that bothers or insults you intellectually, not only do I understand, you're sitting in my old seat. And I have a suggestion for you. If your intellect is offended by some old fool going up here about going on about divine intervention, just substitute the magic from the steps. It'll get you to the same place for now, and it won't insult your sensitive intellect so terribly. But at any rate, it takes divine intervention to get me out of the way, and I hope that for your sake that we can do some of that over the next hour. And Dave and I talked about what I'm going to do with this hour, and I am going to share my experience, strength, and hope, but I'm not going to do it in the form of just telling my personal story. I'm sure I'll weave a good deal of it in there, but I also really want to go through and touch on every one of the 12 steps. So we're going to take a shot at this and see what it looks like. I've never done it before, so we'll let God move my mouth and see what happens. I grew up on a tobacco farm in southwestern Kentucky, right on the Tennessee line. In fact, I've said before that my family really never left Virginia, that you folks left us. We were originally tobacco farmers in what is now Virginia, but when we moved to the Kentucky area, it was a county in Virginia. So you folks left us in that regard. And my early life on that farm, I know now, was not remarkable until I got sober, and I was 37 when I got sober. I thought it was extremely remarkable. I had this really interesting and romantic saga about my early struggles and subsequent rise to power. And of course, it was all about how by my iron will and my sterling intellect, I had pulled myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights I'd reached. And I don't think I was really sober a week until I realized, man, what a load of baloney. We weren't even poor. We weren't anywhere close to poor. We were middle-class farming people who had everything we needed and most of the things we wanted. In fact, my father was the most respected man in the community, and I guess we had more than about anybody in the community, but I didn't see that. That's because without divine intervention, there are no bounds to my capability for self-delusion, just absolutely none. And if I haven't done what I need to do today on steps 10, 11, and 12 to get my daily reprieve and maintain my spiritual condition, I'll go right back to my default position and be just as capable of self-delusion as I've ever been. And if I've learned anything in my time around here, I've learned that I don't get much divine intervention on Sunday based on what I did on Saturday. It's truly a day at a time deal. But at any rate, I met alcohol at 12 or 13, and the first time I was drunk, I was off and running. I was born with some, I guess you'd say, academic gifts, and I was able to stumble upstairs for about 20 years after I started drinking. I wound up being an early admission student in college at 16, and I wound up working and drinking my way through undergraduate and law school, and wound up starting practicing law in Louisville, the big city in Kentucky, as big as it is, in 1968, and practiced for about 10 years until had a good deal of material success. Not as much as I used to think I'd had. You know, that's a peculiarity about staying sober a while, is we get a different focus on our past. But from this vantage point, I was fairly materially successful. I've always been a self-employed criminal defense lawyer, and I always had a knack for getting involved in some cases that had some money and from time to time published in them. And that's what I would stick in your face when you suggested something wrong with the way I live. But almost 10 years after I started practicing law, I got a full of scotch, vodka, and four outside issues, and drove Corvette off-road over 120 miles an hour and just did horrible things to my body. I didn't go back to the law practice for 5 years. I lost some bodily functions permanently. Was in the hospital for more than 6 months of that first year. I wound up, what happened? The phenomenon of craving that was with me from the very first time I got drunk, it progresses. And it had progressed in me to the point where once I got any alcohol in my body, I had just physically lost the ability to stop. And once something separated me from it and something had to intervene and separate me from it, it was 3 or 4 days before I was able to do something like sit up in a chair. But at any rate, long story short on that, during that 5 years between that wreck and the time I got sober, 5 years later, I lost literally everything. A little law firm of 9 or 10 lawyers had built up around this other fellow and myself, and they had to kick me out of that, the firm I'd founded, on account of the social and legal pressure that my behavior brought on them. And state of Kentucky jerked my law license right after that. Young lady I was married to had to leave me on account of my insanity, and she was staying with some girlfriends and died in an accident during that period. My only child, I have another child now, 21 years younger, but Dana, my daughter, was my only child for over 20 years, and I didn't see or have any contact with her for over 3 years. So I had no home, I had no car, my teeth were rotting out of my head. And I wound up getting sober in Nashville, Tennessee. And I'm going to talk a little bit now about step one. And I believe before I start, I do want to tell you this. For me, it's really clear that the only program of recovery we have is steps 1 through 12. Our program of recovery is numbered. And I was told early on, and it was part of what saved my life, I was told that the action that is the first 9 steps in order to move us to a place of recovery, and then immediately followed by the action that is steps 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis in order to maintain our spiritual condition, because we don't get our daily reprieve based on our spiritual condition, thank God. Because there have been a lot of times in this last 39 years when by every standard I could figure out, my spiritual condition was the all crap off. And if my sobriety were dependent on that, I would have been just a sitting duck for being struck drunk. But what the ink on the paper says, it's dependent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And that is the difference in daylight and dark. Because my spiritual condition is something I don't have any immediate power over. I can't wave a wand and change it. On the other hand, the maintenance of it is specific action that is set down in black and white in the big book that I can do regardless of what's going on in the old crazy picture show in the back of my head. So realizing that my daily reprieve is contingent on the action rather than my state of mind turned my daily reprieve from something totally beyond my control into something totally within my control. But at any rate, steps 1 and 2 are different from the rest of the steps in that they don't specifically require action. They require that we reach conclusions. And for many of us on step 1, I break step 1 down to 1A and 1B. Of course, A is admitted we were powerless over alcohol. B is that our lives had become unmanageable. And for many people, it's a huge part of step one to admit to themselves and say out loud, I'm Joe, I'm an alcoholic. That is not my story. I knew intellectually that I was an alcoholic by the time I was in my mid-teens. But I didn't understand what that really meant. You see, I thought I could live with it. I thought I could outsmart it, outrun it, bribe it, something. I knew it was going to be inconvenient, like having a bad arm or a bad leg. And I knew I'd die a lot earlier than a non-alcoholic. But my God, at that age, who wants to live to be 30 or 35 years old and sold, you're no good to yourself or anybody else. But at any rate, what I didn't understand is that I didn't understand what step one conclusions really are. As far as the powerlessness over alcohol, and by the way, I was in some sort of asylum 18 times in 2.5 years on my way to getting sober. By the time I started making the rounds of the asylums, that physical allergy, that physical addiction to ethyl alcohol had progressed in me to the point that I described a few minutes ago. So I didn't have any denial at all, man. Once I got any in my system, I'm powerless. You know, I'm back on the road to a fast track to mad dog death, and I'll stay on that road unless something outside myself knocks me off it. So I would lie in those asylums, and I would think, you know, well, I got it. I understand now. It's like something inside me is worn out. I just can't tolerate it anymore. So that's simple. Just don't put it in your body, Don. You'll be fine. And, of course, in 24 hours after getting out, I'd be on everything I could get my hands on. Because I didn't understand that coupled with that physical allergy is the mental obsession. Now, having a mental obsession isn't really such a harsh-sounding thing. It's kind of a clinical term. But I want to tell you that the mental obsession with alcohol for this alcoholic is an absolute monster. Because what it means is that because of something that's wrong inside of me, that absolutely no human power can do anything about, and yet, if something is not done about it, that thing will ensure that on some day or the other, I will be as powerless over the first drink as I am over the second one or the 20th one. And when you get to that point and accept that you're not only powerless over it once you get it in your body, but you're ultimately powerless over putting it in your body, the poo-poo's getting pretty deep, because step one, I'm convinced, and I don't think there's really any argument about it. If we haven't accepted that we are absolutely beyond human help, I don't believe we have accepted step one of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that I would never, ever have been open to turn into step two if I thought there were any human help that could do anything about my lethal dilemma that I admitted I was in step one. So I had to admit that I'm powerless over whether or not I'm drinking. I had to admit that I'm powerless over all the mind-altering substances that, for me, they're like changing staterooms on the Titanic. I'm going to the same place. There are some things about step one that I really want to share because they were so critical to me. I might not have gotten sober if somebody hadn't finally told me, Don, you are powerless over alcohol. There's certainly no doubt about that. But you are not powerless over your elbow. And you cannot abdicate the total responsibility for what you put in your body to anything or anyone. We can't knock a drink out of your hand, and the God that we revere in here won't knock a drink out of your hand. In the final analysis, you're going to have to help. You're going to have to be a big boy for the first time in your 37 years. You're going to have to, for a while, not do some things you think you're going to burst or splatter all over the wall if you don't do them. And you're going to have to do some things that you think you might splatter all over the wall if you do them. And that sunk in with me. I realized that I was going to have to do the first mature actions I think I'd ever done in my life at that age. And the second step almost killed me. I have no idea where this came from, and I only started telling it in my AA talk just a very few years ago because it sounds so outlandish. But there was a Baptist church, Locust Grove Baptist Church, less than a mile down the road from the tobacco farm where I grew up. And I remember sitting in there when I had to be 4 years old, and it was around Christmas time. And I remember still believing in Santa Claus and not buying a word that preacher was saying. And I have no idea where that came from. But the first 37 years of my life, I was an evangelical agnostic. It was my mission, or part of my mission, to disabuse the superstitious of their superstition. So I had never asked or had ever acknowledged to God that had anything to do with human affairs or my life. And I certainly never asked of God anything. So step two was anathema to me. The mention of God and higher power was even worse, because I knew what you were doing. You were trying to backdoor me on that God crap. Would literally make the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck. And they would run me out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God, alcohol kept running me back in until finally, between God and myself, the miracle was able to happen. But at any rate, I just couldn't get over that. I just couldn't get over it. And when I finally did get sober, I didn't know I was getting sober because my mind hadn't changed about anything. My thoughts, feelings, beliefs didn't change. It's looking in the rearview mirror that I know that something absolutely critical had changed. I had been given the most important life-saving gift that I had ever had or will ever have. And that same gift saves and enhances my life today. And what that was understanding for the first time in my life that I did not have to be a slave to the old crazy picture show in the back of my head. That all those thoughts, feelings, and beliefs that I thought were the ultimate reality for me are really just kind of a will-o'-the-wisp. They're amorphous, and they shift, and they change, and blow away with the wind. And who am I to know what's right for anybody? My God only lights my path with a pin light for the next step, never with a searchlight for the next 100 yards. So I began to understand, because I was told that it would be my actions and not my thoughts, feelings, that determined whether I lived or died. So when I explained to him that I'd tried my best to come to think, feel, and believe like you guys did, and they were telling me I needed to get on my knees and pray morning and night, I nodded at him tearfully, but thought to myself, I'm not going to do that. But see, what that gift really was at the bottom, it was that for the first time in my life, I began voluntarily following suggestions about how to run my life. Even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, I didn't think they would work, and I certainly did not want to do them. And that's the reason that I'm here with you sweet folks tonight instead of having been rotting in a pauper's grave for around 39 years. But at any rate, they explained to me that if I wanted to live, I needed to get on my knees and start taking the action. And that it didn't matter what was going through my head. And over my brain's loud veto, and to my great surprise, in the latter part of April, I started getting on my knees every morning and every night. And to this day, I could count on my fingers the mornings and nights I've missed since then. And I don't know how to stay sober without doing that. I never tell people they have to do anything, but I do tell them to not ask me for any hints on how to stay sober without getting on your knees every morning and every night. And as a result of getting on my knees, and as far as I was concerned, talking to the wall, asking something I did not believe was there to do something that I did not believed could be done. As a result of that, the twin miracles of the second step happened. If I had had to wait until the mental penny dropped, if I'd had to wait until I really did believe that there was some sort of mystical higher power out here that could get me out of that humanly hopeless dilemma that is step one, I'd have been in that pauper's grave. The first miracle was that when I began to behave like a person who believes that, I began to get the benefits of being a believer. And the second part of that twin miracle is that because of taking the action consistent with belief and faith, I came to believe. It turned out that the God thing and faith and belief are just like everything else in my life. I was never able to think my way into right action. I had to act my way into right thinking. After I began to kind of catch on to the spirituality of it, man, I won't tell you, my third step loomed like a behemoth in front of me, because God, there were going to be movie rights to this thing and so on, because it was going to be this great thing of turning my entire will and life over to God. And here's what I had pictured in my head, something like God and I were going to go in this big ornate room that looked something like a federal courtroom on steroids. And God was going to unroll the entire tapestry of my life. And we were going to walk up and down it and discuss it. And I really thought I'd say, make a few suggestions. God say, that's good, Don. I never thought of that. Let's do it this way. But I'd be able to go on spiritual cruise control and always know what to do. Make policy. Never fear from those policies. Well, Cherry Carpenter, my original sponsor in Nashville, told me that the third step didn't turn a thing over to God. It's not designed to. It's the first action step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it means, it tells us specifically how to do a third step. And it tells us that all it is, Bill spends in talking about the third step in about 2.5-3 pages. He uses some form of the word self times. And he sets us up by telling us that what's wrong with us is that ego disorder I call man, the selfishness, self-centeredness that makes me so obsessed with myself, so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people, so obsessed with how I feel, that I believe, along with the ego disorder at the bedrock of my alcoholism, is this simple statement: without divine intervention, I will always wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in the world. Now, without divine intervention, I can give lip service to something being more important. And I might be able to put up a charade or facade for a while, but if I haven't done the work I need to do today to get my help, I'll go back to my default position and let how I feel kick around everything else in my life. Let how I feel and my childish desire to change it be more important than my family, more important than my profession, more important than really whether I live or die, or any relationship that I've been able to cultivate with my God. And I've become convinced that after we have accepted step one, when we know what we are, I believe when we put that first one in, it's the most self-centered act on the face of this earth, short of suicide, because it's a conscious decision. The way I feel and my childish desire to change it is more important than anybody or anything. But at any rate, I approached the Cherry explained to me that the third step is merely a decision to embark on a process that will turn my will in life over to the care of God. He explained that if I heard somebody wondering whether they'd done a third step or not, they probably had not. because you know whether you've gone in the room with an understanding person and said the third step prayer and intended for that to be the watershed moment where you commit to do the rest of the steps the way the book says do them, and you commit when the road forks between what our brain and our fear and our ego wants to do and what we know in our heart, that divine spark, that part of God that's in every one of us, and what we know in our heart is the next right stitch. We're going to try to take that next stitch in the right place instead of where our brain is telling us to take it. And when they told me that, I thought the enemy of the right thing would generally be things like greed and lust. Maybe 1% of the time. 99% of the time, they're fear. Fear that I'll lose something I don't want to lose, or I won't get something I want. Or sometimes for we alcoholics, worst of all, fear I'll look bad. Sometimes I think we're more afraid of looking bad than we are dying. But at any rate, he got it through my head that if I wanted to do the third step, I had to be ready. And he drew my attention to the little paragraph on page 62. And for me, that paragraph is the most important paragraph in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that little paragraph, I think it's 8 lines. Bill Wilson tells us 4 times one of the greatest truths, perhaps the greatest truth I've ever learned or realized in my life. Bill tells us 4 times that we're going to have to quit trying to figure out these patterns and designs of our life so that we'll know where to start stitching. That the fact is that I've got less capability of understanding and comprehending the patterns of my life than a chimpanzee does to master quantum physics. When I'm doing that, when I demand that I figure out the pattern so I'll know where to start stitching, what I really am is an ant floating down the river on a log who thinks he's steering the log, running back and forth, driving himself nuts. Where a sane ant would just do the little ant crap in front of him and let the log go on where he's going anyway. So Bill tells us that we had to quit playing God, because that's playing God. The patterns belong to God, not me. My job is stitching. And God tells me just the next stitch. Like I said, he lights my path with a pen light, not with a floodlight. And then he tells us the 4 different times, he tells us in this drama, we're going to let God be the director and we're going to be the actor. And we're going to let God be the principal or the boss and we're going to be the agent or employee. And we're going to let God be the parent. And then he tells us, same little paragraph. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept, the concept he just told us 4 times, was the keystone, holds it all together, of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed freedom. And then going on to the top, page 63, are the beautiful third step promises. And I'm going to read those. And it begins with, when we sincerely took such a position. There's no other way to read that than when we sincerely took the position that Bill's just told us to take 4 times in the immediately preceding paragraph. All sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, of tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Now I know we call the eighth and ninth step promises the promises, and I don't have a quarrel with that. I guess somebody counted them one time, decided you could argue there are 12 of them. But as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing stronger than those third step promises, and it's all dependent on me stopping trying to run things and me just listening to that divine spark and trying to take the next stitch in the right place. And I've learned that if I will pray to seek to love, comfort, and understand everyone with whom I come into contact and keep running that through my head, and if I'll pray numerous times during the day, God, please, let me give my entire interest, attention, and love to whomever or whatever is in front of me. I live in a different world. I live in an enchanted world. My human relations just flourish on every level in every part of my life when I lay aside whether I get the love, comfort, and understanding. And I'm really listening to you. And I really, for the moment, let you be more important than me. It just sprinkles magic dust on everything. Makes me so much better at my job. God's so much better lawyer than I am. There's no comparison, believe me. But anyway, then he goes on and says that we say the third step prayer to embark on this trip of turning our will and life over to the care of God. Now, in the paragraph after the third step prayer, Bill says, now, of course, the wording is optional as long as we express the main idea. Well, I think that was Bill holding out an olive branch to the Catholic Church, who was very upset with us at the beginning. They saw us as a heresy, which really kind of according to them we are. But they were very upset with us to start with. And so Bill was holding down an olive branch. Let's look at that logically. Why would I use the same brain that destroyed everything in my life to improve on the third step prayer? A prayer that saved and enriched millions and millions of lives. So with that, I headed into the rest of the steps. And the book's very clear that the third step is vital and crucial, but it'll have little permanent effect unless followed at once. Not when we think we're ready, not when our group thinks we're ready or a sponsor, unless followed at once by a fourth step inventory. Well, by that time, I had become so willing to grab hold of that flimsy reed that turned out to be the hand of God, that I was willing to follow directions directly. So sure enough, at once, 8 months later, I started the fourth step. Now, I didn't know I was waiting 8 months to start a fourth step, because you see, I was working on it in my mind, because there were really movie right considerations with that, you know. And I'd call up Terry, my sponsor, and talk to him about some of these fine points so I could get it straight in my mind so I could put it down on paper. And he would say the silliest thing. He would say, Don, it's impossible to start a fourth step without a pencil and a piece of paper and a big book open to page 64. And I would try to explain to him that he didn't understand the complexities that we were talking about. And he'd interrupt me and say again, Don, you can't start a fourth step without a pencil and a piece of paper and a big book open to page 64. And I think what finally got me was when he said, Don, will you let go of this idea that you can take your inventory? Said, of course you can. It's nothing new. You've been trying to do that all your life. You have never found anything remotely as interesting as yourself. And you have spent most of your time trying to figure out what made you tick, what was wrong with you, and look where it got you. And just because you hadn't drank for a few months and been to some meetings, doesn't mean that you have been imbued with the power to take your inventory. He said, what you can do, you can come to this book like a little child. You can go through it, page line for line. And when it tells you to do something, you can stop and do that exactly the way the book says do it. And he pointed out to me that there are three entirely freestanding separate parts of the fourth step. You know, sometimes we hear people talk, you think a resentment list is having done the fourth step. And it's not, it's one third of the fourth step. The book's very clear that the fear list and the sexual inventory are entirely separate and not necessarily even related to the resentment list. In fact, if you counted the words, I think if you took the example on page 65 of a resentment list out, I think Bill probably devotes a few more words to the sexual inventory than he does to the resentment list. And what the book says is that resentment's the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. But it doesn't say that resentment is the number one offender with every single alcoholic. I don't disagree with the book at all. I think it does kill more alcoholics than anything else. But I think there are many like myself who really were not all that bothered by resentment. I wasn't, because I'm so self-centered, I don't give other people much credit for having much impact on my life. None of it, I just don't. Fear, guilt, remorse, those are the things that beat me to death. Just nearly kill me, and they're still my enemies today. I have to go back and remember Jerry's warning that of all human endeavors, the single most useless and counterproductive is self-recrimination. It accomplishes absolutely nothing, and it impedes us in our efforts to do the right thing by knocking us off track, confusing us, paralyzing us. Not that we are sociopathic and don't care the things we did bad, but there's no sense in throwing away today based on what we did yesterday or 40 years ago. But at any rate, I did my fifth step with Cherry. Went back to my attic that I was living in at that time, spent an hour going over steps 1 through 5. See, when I'd done my fourth step, I formed a picture of what a spiritual Don ought to look like. And it looked like to me, you know, I spent 1 hour going through the first 5 steps, like the book says, timed it on my Timex watch, decided I, you know, wasn't a Rhodes Scholar on it, but I'd gotten over the bar. And so I got down on my knees and I said the seventh step prayer, and was convinced that that was where, with God's help, I would work on me to make me into one I decided ought to be a spiritual Don. And I proceeded that way for the next 9 years. Now, or until I was 9 years sober, it was actually more like 8 years that I proceeded that way. And I had a great life. Those times were charmed. At a year and a half sober as a byproduct of steps 8 and 9, my law license got put back in order. I wound up back in Louisville. I had not seen my child for over 3 years. I saw her the second month I was in town. 2 months later, she moved in with me and lived with me all through high school. And we are dear friends, in touch every day to this day. She's been in Al-Anon 30-odd years. And they stuck me up the second month I was back in Louisville trying to practice law. They stuck me up in front of 2,000 people to tell my story. And I thought that was the worst thing that ever happened. Turned out it was the beginning of the rest of my life. Since that time, I've spent a lot more time on Alcoholics Anonymous. The most important part, sitting eyeball to eyeball with one alcoholic, and going through the steps of AA and seeing the miracle happen one more time in someone else. But I've spent it traveling and speaking, sponsoring folks, doing various things in AA, a lot more time than I have trying to make a living. And God's taken care of me just fine. In May of 1990, My name is 9 years sober. All these things were going great. Law practice was going great. I was sponsoring dozens and dozens of people. I'd been speaking all over the country for years. But relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos had nearly killed me. And something happened in May of 90 to cause me to look at 6 and 7 an entirely different way. It caused me to realize, for it to become real inside me, that the 7th step prayer doesn't ask God to remove all my defects of character. It certainly does not ask God to remove the ones that I think are inconsistent with my idea of what a spiritual Don ought to be. What in the world do I know about what God wants a spiritual Don to be? And it's certainly not the ones that are making my self-centered butt uncomfortable. It asks God to remove only the defects of character that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. And that's not peculiar to 6 and 7. It's the backbone of the program of AA. Back to our 3rd step prayer. Take away my difficulties. Not so I can be sober and spiritual and happy. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them will bear witness to those I would help of God's power, love, and way of life. Then when you get to steps 8 and 9 here in a minute, all practical, putting our lives in order, yeah. But if you look on 77, it says we're doing that. But that's not our real purpose. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and those around us. Guys, I've got an illness that is self-centered. I cannot effectively treat it by any form of self-obsession. It doesn't make any difference how I dress it up. I dress it up psychological, spiritual clothing, responsibility clothing, security clothing. Doesn't matter. It's like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. I've got to quit fiddling. I've got to follow directions like a little child and do that 4th step inventory and continue to do the 10th step inventories as I go through life. But I don't need to be dwelling on myself in any form. I need to be trying to help God's kids do what they need to have done and quit worrying about taking care of me and let God take care of me while I try to minister to God's other kids. And I've stumbled that way for it'll be 30 years next month now. And I do mean stumble. I don't think there's been a single day in that 30 years that if you had asked me, Don, did you do the 6 and 7 deal well enough today that it'll do any good, that I would have said, you know, I think I may have gotten over the bar today. Every day I would have said, oh, no, I got knocked over by self-will 50 or 100 times. Had to get completely knocked off track, had to get up, dust myself off, say, oops, Mom, Dad, I'm sorry. Excuse me, stumble another couple of steps in the right direction, whammo, knocked over again. And I thought every time that happened, it was an interruption of my spiritual growth. Turns out that process of persisting after failure, getting up time after time, dusting myself off, asking for the guidance, tuning back into the divine spark, and taking that next stitch in the right place, is the only spiritual growth of which I'm capable. And I'm going to quickly tell you how, despite the fact that it has felt like I'm doing it so poorly, I have persisted. And here's the way it's worked. If in May of 1990, and as I said, I had a great life then, and 9 years sober, if God had said, Don, why don't you make a list of the very best you believe you can have in every single area of your life, the material, the spiritual, your primary relationship, your children, your life in AA, your law practice, your reputation in the legal profession, everything, the house you live in, the cars you drive. And God has said, whammo, you got it. Please believe me. I'm not gilding the lily. I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. When I'm willing to seek to behave like, I've let go of all my self-determined objectives, and that I'm really interested in doing God's will, one stitch at a time, and to help my fellows, God takes me places that I couldn't even imagine. It's been an unbelievable trip. But at any rate, 89, as I already mentioned, that's where my law license got put back in order, and I'm going to move quickly through that. I think if my objective had been to get a law license, I would never have got one. As it was, I only got it grudgingly by one single vote of the bar governors. Because when I had lost my license, it wasn't whatever happened to Don. It was on the front page of the Louisville Courier Journal. I'd given the law profession a terrible black eye. But as a byproduct of just trying to set things right, my law license got put back in order and even wound up being done retroactively. You check my record with Kentucky Bar today, I've been a continuous member in good standing with no complaints since 1968. And I spent almost 4 years without a law license, starving to death. The forgiveness of non-alcoholics for us, when we finally start trying to do the right thing, passes all understanding. It's not even fair. We get treated better than the poor schmuck that never fouled up. We truly are the prodigal children. We just get treated so beautifully. But at any rate, the things about 89 that I really want to share are, number one, I think the ninth step is the single place in the step process where it is most critical to work closely with the sponsor, because there's so much danger. There's danger of overlooking or shirking from amends that we're going to have to make if we're going to stay sober. And there's so much danger of damaging or injuring the people we're trying to make amends to, or call ourselves making amends, and innocent bystanders. You know, the step says we make amends wherever possible, except when it would injure them or others. Well, I'm not an other, but all the people who depend on me, my wife, my children, that cat that won't stop mewing in the background, the people that depend on me in my professional life, those are others. And before I do something rash, I need to understand all of the ramifications of what I'm getting ready to do. I need to do it prayerfully, with careful conversation with my sponsor, with my spiritual advisor, and make sure, because if that other person is not pretty darn sure to be better off after I do my amends, I don't do them. Just give you a silly little example. Many times over the years, after I've given a talk somewhere, people come up hugging me and, you know, telling me they like my talk. You know, no, rarely does anybody come and tell you that was crappiest talk I ever heard. But every once in a while, one of them would say, "I need to tell you, Don, I had never met you till now, but I had a real resentment against you for 10 years. But I got over it now, and I just wanted you to know that." He walks off and I ain't feeling any better. In fact, to stand there the rest of the time, people come down hugging me, wondering what I did to offend that guy so badly. Also, you don't run over to your next door neighbor and say, "You don't know it, but I had an affair with your wife a few years back. But I'm sober now and trying to live a spiritual life, so I have to clean it up and be honest. Oh, I feel better. I hope you have a good night." We have to understand that the amends are not about us. They're not about how we feel. Now, we're going to feel an awful lot better as a result of making amends properly as a byproduct, but the amends are all about the other person. They're all about trying to put that person, as best we can, back in the position they would have been in had it not been for our bad behavior. That's what amends amount to. But at any rate, then 10, 11, and 12, I've already mentioned that, thank God, that daily reprieve is based on my action to maintain my spiritual condition. Step 10 contains what a dear friend of mine says is the most important word in the 12 steps, continued. Because when I get in trouble today, sometimes I'll think, you know, after all, you know, I've sponsored all these people, I've talked to all these places, heck, I'm Don M. I need to find some real guru somewhere, or some esoteric spiritual truth that'll lift me out of this. You know what I need to do? The same thing I need to do when I was 30 days sober. Go to more meetings, pray more, talk to my sponsor. Continuing is what this thing's all about. We will grow. Oh, yes, we will grow. But the growth will come as a result of continuing. And can I break 10 down into A and B. Continue to take in the personal inventory, and that includes page, it's actually, it's step 11 technically, but on page 86, I try to run through those questions of when we retire at night. It includes a periodic house cleaning of an inventory that looks just like a fourth step. They are not fourth steps to me. They are 10th step work, because I don't need to be involved in a never-ending process where I'll always be a little crippled, sick alcoholic and not be able to deal with this world on this world's terms. I need to understand that if I have done steps 1 through 9, the way the book said, and I'm living in the fellowship, and I'm living in steps 10, 11, and 12, I will be at least as capable of dealing with this world on this world's terms as a person who never had alcoholism. And that was really stressed to me, because Cherry, my sponsor, knew that I was perfectly capable of being 30 years dry and sitting in a clubhouse somewhere playing euchre and whining about them earth people out there, that I couldn't go work with them. They didn't understand me, and they might get me drunk. He wanted me to understand that a far more important demonstration, as the book says on page 19, a far more important demonstration than NAA of these principles is in our respective homes and vocations. That's where the rubber meets the road, is there. Step 11 was my favorite steps until May of 1990, when 6 and 7 tempo came over. I love step 11. Reading pages 86, 87, 89 is still part of my morning routine every morning. And I want 86, 87, 88. And I'm out of time, but I'm going to go about 5 or 10 minutes over here, if you don't mind, folks, and we'll have a little shorter question and answer. The thing I want to emphasize about the 11th step, and we all have our morning prayer and meditation routines, and we all have our nightly routine. Well, my problem was and is that I do that, and I think I'm doing the 11th step. And I'm doing about anywhere 2 to 5% of the 11th step. Because there's 95 to 98% of the day between those two times. And I overlook the most powerful and wonderful little explicit directions that begin on the bottom of page 87 and end on 88. It's all in one paragraph. This is the second most important paragraph in the big book to me today. I'm going to read it. Says, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated to doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show. The word constantly, I was told, was in there because we are constantly trying to run it. Humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, in quotation marks, so it's not just a vague suggestion, thy will be done. And then going on in the same paragraph, we get the ultra practical, beautiful 11th step promises. We are then, when we do what we just read, that's all there is to it. Pause when we agitated or doubtful, constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show, and humbly say to ourselves many times each day, regardless of what's going on, thy will be done. Here's what happens. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. And that magical paragraph is followed by the shortest paragraph in the big book. It works. It really does. And I can't tell you what a difference it makes in my life when I live the other 98% of the 11th step in the day. And I add to that will be done. I add to seek to love, comfort, and understand, and to seek to give my entire interest, attention, and love to whomever or whatever is directly in front of me. Step 12. Main thing I want to say about step 12 is covered in the opening sentences of paragraph of the chapter Working with Others. It says that nothing will so much ensure our immunity from drink as intensive work with other alcoholics. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not in any way diminishing the necessity and value of meetings, doing the rest of the steps, prayer, sponsors, they're all absolutely essential. But they are not as effective in keeping us physically away from ethyl alcohol as intensive work with other alcoholics. Nothing will do so much to keep us away from alcohol as that. And my life is a testament to that. In the last 39 years, folks, I think I made about every spiritual mistake you can make. But by the grace of God, I've always been willing to answer the bell when there was an opportunity in the early years just to help another alcoholic. But for the last 30 years, it's just helping another human being, because that's what this deal is all about. It's not about me. When I make it about me again, I go right back into the snake pit. But when I lay me aside and I make it about you, and I make about what I can do by giving my interest, attention, and love to whomever or whatever is right in front of me, God makes me better at everything than I could ever have dreamt of being. Thank you guys so much. And this has been an adventure for me. I'm sure it was for you too. God bless. And let's open up for questions.
Oh, Don, thank you so much. I never get out without crying. I'm going to give everybody an opportunity to unmute themselves if they would like to just say thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for the pearls.
Thanks, Don.
Good to see you too, David Francis.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, Don.
Awesome.
Thanks, Don.
Thanks, Don.
All right, I'm gonna take it back for now. and allow Don to take a little break. We'll do a little seven tradition and announcements and things like that. If you want to step down for a moment, Don, you're welcome to, or just hang out. Let's see. So, and hopefully people have been submitting questions. We're going to have Don back in just a minute, and hopefully Larry's going to feed those to me. Send your questions to the user questions. We're going to pass the seven tradition basket virtually. I'm going to put some links up and copy those and paste those to everyone. Like a well-oiled machine, it's running in here tonight, huh? Okay. Basically, what you'll see there is the Tidewater Intergroup, AA.org, and a link to the Area 71 Virginia District. The Seven Tradition says every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, Seven Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. I'll take a couple of announcements. If there's like 10, I'm not going to do them. Anybody want to raise their hand? While you're thinking about that, the Simple Actions Group is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your virtual hands. And we want to say that sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we'll be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. If you came in alone, you don't have to leave that way. And if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So I'm going to unmute Mr. Don, and hopefully our questions are coming in. And I got one quick one, Don. I've heard you tell this story before, but I love it, and it has to do with financial amends. And you tell the story, you set the scene by bringing us into you taking the inventory of your estate in the room over a garage,
right?
Is that enough for you? It's just a lot of us struggle with financial amends,
right? Well, I certainly did. I learned some real lessons while I was indigent and unemployed and unemployable in Nashville, Tennessee, for the first year and a half or more that I was sober. One lesson I learned is that if you've got $20 and owe $40, it'll drive you crazy. But if you've got $20 and owe $250,000, man, you got $20, you're in good shape. I think I know what David's asking about. And it's such an example of the eighth and ninth step promise that the fear of people will lose us, will leave us as a result of the steps. I owed way up in six figures, which is a lot of money today, but it was a mountain in 1981, to seven different sources in Louisville, Kentucky. And I was scared to death. I didn't have a telephone, so didn't have to worry about them bothering me. But I did have a mailbox, and I was scared. I had a rock in my belly every time I'd go to that mailbox. Every time I'd walk in the clubhouse there in Nashville, I was scared old Morris behind the counter was going to say, "Don, that fellow from Louisville called down here looking for you." I was terrified of it. Well, in the course of 8 and 9, I sat down in the middle of my attic, and I took inventory of my estate. And as David mentioned, that my estate was 14 $1 bills and a half pack cigarettes. And I wrote seven letters to the people and institutions that I owed that money to. I told them where I was without telling them more about alcoholism than they necessarily needed to know. And I let my sponsor read those letters. And I said, this is precisely where I am. This is how you can reach me. Now, I don't know, and I was doing that long before I got a law license back. And I was unemployed. So I said, I don't know whether I will ever be able to pay you off or not. But I can promise you this, that you will, that if I can, I ever will. I will. Yeah, I can, I will. And if you, you'll never again have to wonder where I am, that I will keep you apprised of exactly where I am. You won't have any trouble getting hold of me. And I mailed those letters. And within 72 hours, I would have been okay running into any of those people on the street. That terror that had been kicking me around and dominating me for so long was just gone. But maybe David won't hear about the second part of that story. Got the law license back. I got back to Louisville. My daughter wound up moving into it with me. And man, things are happening so fast that I kept going to go around and start paying on these things. And, you know, I think like most alcoholics, I have some sort of vague idea that what I'd really like to do is have it all in cash in a paper bag and say, here's your dang money. But I got as uncomfortable as I was before I wrote the letters after about a year. So I started sending embarrassing checks. I mean, embarrassing $10 checks, you know, on five-figure, six-figure debts. But once I started back sending those checks, the freedom came back to me and the fear left me. And I proceeded that way. And the month that I was 15 years sober, I made the last payment on the financial wreckage of my past. But I didn't have to live in any discomfort on account of that all those years, because I was doing what I needed to do. I was happy, joyous, and free. And I didn't suffer any indignity, any pain, anything because of it. But was that what you were asking, basically, David? You're muted, David.
Perfect, Don. Thank you so much. When you talked about the freedom that came just from dropping those $2 envelopes in the mailbox, that changed a trajectory in my life, in my recovery. So thank you. I got,
excuse me, David, but I've said that I split my estate with them. I put a $1 bill in each of the seven envelopes. So go ahead, David. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Don. I've got kind of two questions. I'm going to roll up into one. Under what circumstances would you separate separate from a sponsee, and have you ever considered getting a new sponsor in your time?
Well, I've been very blessed in that I have never considered changing sponsors. Now, and when I moved away from Nashville back to Louisville, and though we are 200 miles apart here, I needed somebody close to me, as well as needing Cherry in Nashville. So I operated with two sponsors for 8 years until Cherry died. Cherry died in the winter of 89-90. And I had Bernie in Louisville, who continued to be my sponsor until his death in 99. And then I got Tom B. from Avon Lake, Ohio, and I have Bob Bazan. So, no, I've never considered changing this, but my sponsor, just because I thought I'd be better off with another sponsor. And as far as separating myself from a sponsee, I've never done that. If it gives them some benefit to call me a sponsor, I'm not embarrassed because somebody says I'm their sponsor, and that has nothing to do with me, what they do. But I've told a whole bunch of folks, it doesn't look like what we're doing working. And if I were you, I would change something, get another sponsor, something. And the way I sponsor, I don't have set, you know, rules, blam, 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 you do things this way. And I've sent a lot of guys to the groups here in town that are really structured, you know, make you wear a suit and tie all the time and, you know, just really, really, you know, I would never call a Nazi AA, although I did use to sponsor the Reichsführer with the group down there. But my point is that a lot of those guys have flourished in that environment, gone on, and some of them are sober now 25 years and helping loads of people. So, no, I don't fire anybody, but I do point them in a different direction if I feel like it'd be better for them.
Okay. And Lisa has an interesting question. What does freedom mean to you in recovery?
Well, it's more than just another word for nothing left loose.
Nice.
Cherry Carpenter defined freedom as doing the right thing because I want to do it. And I'm on board with Cherry that I am free when I'm doing the right thing and it coincides with what I want to do. I am free.
All right. Let's see. How do you teach a sponsee to do the fourth step, particularly the third and fourth column? Is there such a thing as overwriting your inventory?
Oh my God, yes. Yes, there's such a thing in it. You know, inventory is not the story of your life. When I take people through the fourth step, I use just the book. And I use, in the early years, back in the 80s, when I was sponsoring people, as we would go through every line in the book from page 64 to 70, either I would have the sponsee take notes or I would write down things, you know, that are in the book, just more or less highlighting them, pointing out what the ink on the paper says. And I was sponsoring a guy that was locked up a long way away. So I wrote him a letter with the same thing in it that the notes were in for those people. And he got out and did beautifully and sober 12 years, helped world of people before he died in a car wreck. But he liked that and he took it out of letter form, started giving it to people, and then got back to me. So I give them that, and there's nothing in it that's not in the big book. I don't criticize, you know, any of the recovery dynamics or anything, but I'm kind of like Jerry Carpenter. I'm going to get in all the other stuff as soon as I master the big book. And Jerry never got it mastered, and I ain't got anywhere close to mastering it. So pages 64 to 70 are fully sufficient as far as I'm concerned. And besides, it's not figuring out yourself. The value of the fourth step is following directions like a little child, accepting that we can't figure ourselves out and letting our inventory emerge as a result of following directions like a little child. It's not about using our wonderful intellect. We've been doing that all our lives to try to figure ourselves out. It's about coming like a little child and following directions.
Thank you. Do you have any comments or thoughts or on the 12 and 12?
I like the 12 and 12. The thing I quote most on the 12 and 12 is the prayer of St. Francis on page 99. And the 12 and 12 is very helpful. When I find any conflict between the 12 and 12 and the big book, I completely ignore what the 12 and 12 said. And that my personal belief is that Bill was inspired by God when he wrote the big book. And it's a matter of history that he was under the influence of a psychiatrist when he wrote 12-12. So if I find, I'm not criticizing in any way, I'm just so helpful the 12 and 12 is. But if I find any conflict, I go right back to the basics, go right back to the big book. That's where I find my answers.
All right. After being sober for decades, do you find you need sponsorship less?
Well, certainly I don't need to call a sponsor every day in order to stay sober. But I never get away from needing the guidance. When you're in a position where you've got, you're sponsoring a lot of people who have as much or more time as you do, you get a lot of the benefits from people you sponsor. You really do. But I don't hesitate to call Bob B. He and I were friends for 35 years before he became my sponsor. But I use Bob and I use him as a sponsor. And if Bob tells me to do that, he thinks I ought to do something, I'll do it.
All right. Here's a tasty one. A member asks, how do we get freedom from the guilt and shame of past choices made in recovery?
Okay. Well, when I quoted Jerry Carpenter on earlier, applies to things we do in recovery too. God knows I've done a lot of things in recovery that I'm, you know, that are shameful and that I've suffered a lot of remorse over. But the past is the past, whether it's 50 years ago or 5 seconds ago. And there's no way to change it. All we can do is try to amend it. All we can do is try the best we can to set things right or set things back the way they would have been had it not been for our bad behavior. I know this is not spiritual. I know it's actually a quote from a mafia don. Except I'm adding to it, after doing all we can to make amends, if you did something bad, forget it. If you did something good, forget it. And go on and give my interest, attention, and love to whomever or whatever is in front of us. Listen, if we could only get valid messages from perfect messengers, not a single one of us would ever get a single valid message. So just because we are flawed doesn't mean that God can't use us as tools. In fact, God uses our flaws. When my phone rings today to do something in AA, speak or sponsor, whatever, a big percentage of the time, that call would not have happened had I not suffered the way I did with my character defects, with women and money for 9 years sober, and I finally found a way to let God take a better place. So God weaves my mistakes into the toolbox of what there is for God to work through me to help other people. So that's best I can do on it, I think.
Thank you. Do you participate in other 12-step programs?
No.
Okay. So we don't need to ask you how you balance that then. Let's see. You ever have trouble practicing these principles in all your affairs?
Only about 50 times a day. It's a matter of persistence. It's a matter of persistence in the course of a conversation with somebody. I'll remember that I'm supposed to be trying to love, comfort, and understand them instead of thinking about whether I'm getting what I want out of the conversation. So I think persistence, I think the two most underrated of all spiritual characteristics are persistence and courtesy. If I am courteous, I'm so far down the road to loving, comforting, and understanding other people. And if I'm courteous, it just does a world for everything. And I've come to the conclusion that it is impossible to be discourteous and spiritual at the same instant. They are mutually exclusive. And it's all about persistence. When I was talking about stumbling a couple of steps and getting knocked over and getting up and starting over, it's all about persistence. Just keeping on, keeping on. The journey is the destination. There isn't any destination we're going to get to where all of a sudden we're going to have graduated and not make any more mistakes. So persistence is huge with me. Thanks.
All right. Now, I don't know if your sponsees call you with relationship issues, but somebody wants to know, when your sponsee is having trouble with your relationship, what is your go-to advice to solve the problem? Is there such a thing as going too quickly or slowly through the steps? I guess that's two different questions. Sorry. How do you help people calling you with relationship issues?
On the relationship thing, everybody that I've ever begun to sponsor, I've told them up front, for me to give advice on relationships ought to be a felony based on my overall history. On the other hand, I've got 30 years of total peace and just an unbelievable life with my sweet Sharon. And what I tell them is usually something like this. Hey, you're not going to change the other person. You got two choices. Either seek to love, comfort, and understand them, and stop keeping score. Because if you keep score in a relationship, you're always going to think you get the short end of the stick. And go out of your way to be courteous to your mate. You know, we're more courteous sometimes to strangers than are the people we live with. And that's so sad, because I don't care if it's flying under a banner of humor. Every one of those jabs leaves a scar. Every one of them leaves a scar. And really, I basically tell them, you got two choices. Either take that route and make it about trying to make things better for your mate, or leave, because you ain't ever going to change the mate. And that's basically what I tell them.
Thank you. Is there such a thing as going too quickly or too slowly through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous?
Oh, I don't know. Dr. Bob was running around Akron doing amends the day he had his last beer that morning. And sure, it requires more time than that to properly digest the conclusions in one and two, and to realize the import of the action we're taking in the rest of the steps. So I like to see people move through the steps. I don't like to see them get hung up. What I really, really hate for people to do is do their fifth step and take a break. Because I've had a lot of people call me and say, Don, I did my fifth step 2 months ago or 5 years ago, and things are not better, they're worse. But when I do some cross-examination about having proceeded with 6, 7, 8, and 9, and then living on 10, 11, and 12, I usually find out that they haven't done that. So I ask that they can continue with the steps at that point.
This may be pertinent to more than one person here tonight, but what about I continue to suffer from fear of financial insecurity?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not immune from it. You could have put a pistol to my head and got me to look at my retirement account 3 weeks ago. We all feel that insecurity from time to time. Again, it's a matter of persistence. When I pull back in the moment, and all I ever have is this moment, and when I start feeling uneasiness about that or anything on the economic area level, I remember that God has always taken care of me, and that without God, everything's down the drain anyway. And I pull into the moment and I make a gratitude list. Writing down a gratitude list is one of the most helpful tools that I've ever found. And when I realize that all I have is today, and that I'm fine today, and something that's been clear to me a long time, human security is a myth. There is no such thing as human security. So all any of us can ever be is okay in the right now, in a series of right nows. And when I can live there, it chases away that fear of economic insecurity.
Well, I'm afraid we have reached the end of our time. Don, is there anything you'd like to part with, or have we rung you out?
Well, I do have one thing that I wish I'd said. I started to say it and got off on a rabbit track. The action that is the 12 steps works on alcoholism exactly like penicillin works on an infection. If I've got an infection that's going to kill me, I don't need to know the nature or origin of my infection. I could learn everything there is to know about the stupid infection, and if I don't take the pills, I'm dead. I don't need to understand how penicillin works in the human body. I don't need to believe it'll work, and I don't even need to want to take the pills. That's irrelevant. If I've got the infection and take the pills as directed, I'll get just fine. And I was guaranteed that the action that is the 12 steps will work on alcoholism exactly that way. And the fact that I'm here instead of the pauper's grave is a pretty good indication they were right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good night to all. I love you all, and thank you so much for
your
attention and love and patience.
Thank you so much. I've given everybody the power to unmute themselves if they'd like to say thank you again.
Love you, Don. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hey, Debbie.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don.
Glad to see everybody.
Thanks, Don.
Appreciate you, Don.
Thank you from Idaho.
Hey, Jenny.
Thank you, Don.
Hey.
Good to see you.
All right. I'm going to take it back real quick. So again, thank you, Don, so much. This was just absolutely wonderful. I'd like to thank everyone who participated, everyone who helped co-chair and take questions. Larry, that was amazing. And again, you have the power to unmute yourself if you would like to join in the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. I love you guys.
Great. Bye, everybody, and thank you so much.
Love you so much, Don. Thank you.
Amazing.
Thank you.
So much.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
That was great.